Okay, good evening, everybody. Our topic for tonight is the Jewish community in early Republican America. In other words, what happened to the Jews of the United States between about the year 1783, when the Revolutionary War ended, and roughly the year 1820, when, for convenience sake, we will say that the Sephardic colonial period of dominance comes to an end, followed by a significant influx of Central European / German Jews who changed the face of the American Jewish community. So after the Revolutionary War, American Jews thought to themselves that we now have the world to begin again, that life was good, was pretty good under in the colonial regime, and the war upset the situation, caused a lot of chaos and some death. And now that the war is over, it's an opportunity to rebuild what once was and make it even better. So it's a time of optimism, reconstruction, revitalization, and expansion. The old congregations were rebuilt, and new ones were formed. But it should be noted that the vigor of the community did not come from population growth. In fact, the population of Jews in the United States was basically stagnant. There were probably about 2,500 Jews in 1776, and by 1820, there are 2,700. So there's basically no increase anything to speak of. There aren't that many Jews who immigrate to the United States during this time. Some come from Curacao, some come from Jamaica, and a smattering come from Bordeaux in France. But basically, the American Jewish community will rise and fall on their own merits without the advantage of fresh blood from the outside. So they will do well if they can marry amongst themselves and strengthen their community, and they will do poorly if they acculturate, assimilate, intermarry, and die off. Okay, so most of the Jews of this period lived in one of six communities: New York, Charleston, Savannah, Richmond, Philadelphia, and Baltimore. Of those six, four of them had been important during the colonial period. Baltimore and Richmond were not. Baltimore and Richmond were relatively new. There was a community which was very important in the colonial period, which I didn't mention, and that is Newport. The Newport community and the Lancaster, Pennsylvania community were basically gone. As the economies in those towns declined, the Jews left. And once enough Jews leave an area, and only a small number remain, less than a critical mass, then religious services come to an end, and the communal life just doesn't exist anymore. There was a tremendous degree of geographic mobility during this period, beginning with people returning home from their places of exile where they had spent the war years. So the Philadelphia community, which had been greatly augmented by refugees from New York, from Savannah, Charleston, and basically had more than half the American Jewish population in Philadelphia during the war, or the latter years of the war, they built a shul in 1782, and they took on tremendous communal expenditures. But the problem is that people left after 1783. All those who were not indigenous to native to Philadelphia went back to their old homes. And so the community in Philadelphia was left holding the bag. They had tremendous financial obligations to support a synagogue edifice and other institutions, and they just couldn't pay for it anymore. And they had to ask the state legislature for the right to do a bingo night or a lottery of some kind to raise money, because they just didn't have enough money to pay the bills. Okay. The community in Newport tried to recover after the end of the British occupation. They tried. But the economy was no longer suited for old-style shipping merchants, which the Jews had typically been in the colonial period. So the synagogue closed in 1792, and the Jews moved to other cities, whether in New York, Virginia, or South Carolina. The Jewish community in Lancaster had been doing very well and was even considering building a synagogue, building a house of worship in 1781, but the community collapsed because the frontier moved further west. Now, America is a frontier country, but the frontier is always moving further and further west. Manifest destiny, we're going to go from sea to shining sea. So when the hinterlands are in the vicinity of Lancaster, so they people can live there and make money conducting trade. But when the civilization extends another 100 miles further west, Lancaster serves no more purpose anymore. Okay. Many Jews moved from Philadelphia and Lancaster to Baltimore. Baltimore was the up-and-coming commercial center. It was going to be the next biggest thing. But much of the movement to Baltimore was transient. People didn't stay there for a long time. And so despite there being a considerable number of Jews in Baltimore, they didn't build a shul until after the 1820s, long after the first Jews arrived there. Only one Jew lived in Richmond before the Revolution, and yet by 1789 they had a synagogue going, and by 1820 they had 191 Jews and became a very important Jewish community in the Confederacy later during the Civil War. Some of the shul's founders, however, moved out of town, moved to Baltimore, New York, and Philly. Everybody was looking for the next big economic opportunity. Nobody was really all that devoted to their kahila, to their city, to their community. Everybody's looking for themselves to make a buck, to make a parnassa. The Savannah community reestablished itself in 1786 after the war. But because they had small numbers and they had economic downturns and they had a fire at the site of the synagogue construction, all sorts of reasons, it didn't work out for them to have a shul until about 1820. Now, Savannah might have grown even more if it weren't for the fact that Charleston is not that far away, and Charleston was the bigger attraction. In 1790, there were 200 Jews in Charleston. By 1820, there were 700 Jews in Charleston. And to figure out how much 700 means, it doesn't sound like a lot to us, but at that time, it was 5% of the total white population of the city. Jews are accustomed to being, 1%, 0.5% of the population, not 5% of the population, certainly not in early America. And yet in Charleston in 1820, of the white population, so ignoring the slave population or freed blacks, 5% of the city was Jewish. That's a significant percentage. It means the Jews are no longer tucked away in the corner. They play an important role in the civic life of the city. Okay. By contrast, in New York, there were 550 Jews at that time, and they were only 0.5% of the white population of the city. And so in Charleston, they began construction on the synagogue in 1792. They dedicated it in 1794. And this was an important thing to have a project to work on because the community had been divided between loyalists and patriots. Half of the Jews of Charleston supported the British crown, and half had been supportive of the American Revolution. After the war, it was not easy for people who had been on opposite sides of the political aisle to get together for, peace and harmony. But the building of a synagogue was what brought them back together. Amen. Good. Between 1780 and 1820, the emphasis on careers is as merchants shipping around the Atlantic declined. Instead, there was a greater diversification of the occupational profile of American Jews. They became lawyers, they became tobacconists, store owners, small-time manufacturers, even petty farmers, or operating the general store. They did all sorts of things. The economic profile was now diversified. The reason for the decline in merchant shipping among Jews was a few reasons, actually. One, the disruption in trade between the United States and England as a result of the Revolutionary War and the ill will between England and the U.S. even after the war. The danger of the high seas, including eventually Barbary pirates. The undeclared naval war against France in the 1790s. Chaos in Europe during the Napoleonic period. The War of 1812. And a depression in 1819. So for that whole 40-year stretch, it wasn't so profitable, or it was a dangerous gamble to remain in the Atlantic shipping industry. It was better to do other things for a living. Okay. The Jewish community in New York was reestablished under Gershom Mendes Seisius in 1783. The community expanded its charitable services and volunteer organizations. In 1818, they even built a new synagogue building. In the Republican era, there was a greater acculturation among Jews than there had been in the colonial period. Synagogues became more noticeably American. Jews began using translations of the Siddur to daven because they didn't know Hebrew. The dedication of the synagogue in Savannah in 1820 included the playing of an organ And Masonic rites. Similarly in Charleston in 1794, it looked like a typical Georgian church or a British church with a spire, a Protestant church, on the outside at least. And there were Masonic rites at its dedication. So while there was borrowing from Christianity and Freemasonry with regard to the synagogue building, there was borrowing from the American political milieu with regard to synagogue governance. Synagogues began writing constitutions and even contemplated bills of rights for their members, as I mentioned last week. Synagogue officers were now chosen by more democratic means, by the annual vote, the annual membership meeting where there's an election held. And shuls still do this today, the annual meeting, okay? And it's always a struggle to get a quorum for that annual meeting. Nobody wants to go, because it's a fait accompli. Various changes in bylaws dramatically reduced the traditional supreme authority of the Ma'amad that was held in the Spanish-Portuguese synagogues. So whereas in the old days it was an autocracy or a rule by a small cabal of elites, the more American synagogue, as we go into the 19th century, will truly be a democracy. Okay. Also what changes is the role of the Chazan. The Chazan becomes more and more like a Protestant minister. He, the Chazan, rather than the Parnas, who is a layman, represents the Jewish community to the outside world at important civic functions. Gershom Mendesatius, the Chazan of Sheriff Israel in New York, was appointed to the board of Columbia University, just like the other leading clergymen of the various denominations were in New York City. It was a tradition. If you're a leading clergyman, you're on the board of Columbia. Well, who is the Jewish clergyman? Who's the Jewish rabbi, quote unquote, even though he's not at all a rabbi? Satius, he's the Chazan, it's close enough. He participated in organizing various municipal celebrations and fasts together with the other clergy. He was called Reverend, despite totally lacking any rabbinic credentials. To an extent, the state of New York foisted this on Sheriff Israel because it required a religious society to have a quote-unquote minister in order for it to incorporate. Satius then took advantage of the situation and began giving sermons every Shabbos, and they sounded a whole lot like Protestant sermons. So this was a self-willed acculturation by Gershom Mendesatius. Synagogues in the early Republican period tried to reimpose sanctions on those who violated religious law. No synagogue honors if you eat treif or you work on Shabbos. And shuls put in tough laws on intermarriage. By inference, we can understand that at the time, intermarriage was a growing problem. But a few years after these rules, these tough rules about you have to keep kosher and Shabbos, otherwise you get no kibbudim, a few years after these rules were promulgated, they were very quickly dropped. What does reverend imply? It implies that you are revered for your religious status, that you have some sort of ecclesiastical significance that has to be respected. Okay. So a few years after these rules were put into place, they were dropped, and nobody was seriously punished for religious laxity by the 1790s and early 1800s. Why not? Because almost nobody was from. Well, I wouldn't say nobody, but enough people were cavalier about religious observance that it was no longer practical for the community to try to impose these kind of stiff punishments. There was also an insufficient interest in Jewish education. People just didn't care about giving their kid a Jewish education. As we would see in late 20th century America, and for them in early 21st century America, that whereas Jews are neurotic about how good their kid's secular education is, outside of a small cohort of Orthodox Jews, most American Jews don't give a damn about their kid's Jewish education. It's just not all that important to them. If they could read the Aleph Beis for the Bar Mitzvah and read a few lines out of the Haftorah, they think that's impressive. So the same thing was true in early Republican period. Not enough parents wanted to give their kid an education. The school that was operated by Sheriff Israel had to close down multiple times between 1801 and 1818, and then eventually just ceased functioning for lack of dues-paying students. Okay, the synagogues also ceased to regard helping the poor as part of their responsibilities, meaning the shul is the shul, and the fact that the kehillah, the broader Jewish community, has impoverished people, well, the community has to take care of that, but not the synagogue. So we see a bifurcation of responsibilities, that the shul is no longer the totality of the kehilah. It's just a synagogue, which might also do some educational work, but basically is a house of prayer. Now, because of this, new volunteer organizations will have to develop, including those for poor relief, burial societies, bikur cholim, taking care of orphans, etc., etc. That these are now organizations that will come about and be supported by righteous and pious Jews, but not in the context of the Beit Knesset. Okay. There was a diminished commitment in the early Republican period to a distinctive fellowship of co-religionists. In other words, your social circle was not going to be distinctively Jewish and people who pray and behave like you, but rather your social circle was going to include non-co-religionists, people of other faith groups, and you weren't going to look all that different. You were going to blend in. Matters were made worse for the survival of the various communities and the various synagogues by the Ashkenazi-Sephardi fissure, which emerged in the final decades of the 18th century. In Charleston, by the 1780s, there were two competing ethnic congregations, neither of which had their own synagogue building, though they eventually reconciled and built the structure in the early 1790s. In Philadelphia, Ashkenazim permanently broke away around the year 1800, forming the German Society of Rodef Shalom. So that became the first instance of a Jewish community in a given city, American city, where there are two separate and distinct synagogues that operate independently. In New York, the breakaway shul doesn't come into existence until 1825. Sherit Israel has a monopoly over synagogue life in New York until 1825, which at that time, B'nai Yeshur and BJ comes into existence as a more religious breakaway. Of course, the irony is that BJ today is a left-wing conservative shul run by anti-Zionist rabbis, as opposed to Sherit Israel, which is still an Orthodox Spanish-Portuguese synagogue run by Rabbi Soloveitchik. So the irony is that Sherit Israel wasn't frum enough. BJ was being extra frum, but the roles were eventually reversed. Okay. But even though there was no breakaway synagogue until 1825, the underlying issues which would cause the fissure had already been around for a few decades. And what were those issues? Well, number one, the lack of Jewish education, that certain people, especially the more recent arrival Ashkenazim, were interested in giving their kids Hebraic education, whereas the old-line Spanish-Portuguese Jews were indifferent. There was the price of honors that the old-line Spanish-Portuguese elite could afford, but the newer arrivals could not because they were still making their way financially. And there was the role of the Chazan, which, as far as the Sephardim were concerned, had evolved naturally and they accepted it. But for the Ashkenazim, this was totally bogus. A Rav is a Rav and a Chazan is a Chazan and a minister in America is bogus, has no credentials whatsoever. It's just a guy with a collar on his neck, okay? So the divide was not necessarily along Ashkenazic Sephardic lines in the sense of, I want this liturgy, I want that liturgy, the Nusach. But rather it was a divide between newer Americans who wanted a greater traditionalism and older Americans who had become accustomed to the style of the American synagogue, which was different from the old world. So socioeconomic differences proved to be decisive rather than purely ethnic motivations. Moshe is asking me, when does the American reform begin? So good news, next Monday night, we're going to speak about that at length. We're going to speak about what happens in the synagogues in the 1820s. The various breakaways, including in Charleston, where you'll have the Charleston Experiment in Reform in 1824, which will be the first real attempt at reform. It doesn't go over well. It sort of fizzles out and then has to reemerge in the 1840s. Okay, but now I want to talk about, for the next 40 minutes, I want to discuss what I mentioned last time I would talk about, and that is Washington's letter to the Jews in the context of what is the citizenship status of American Jews in the post-Revolutionary War period. So, America was seen by some people, including some Jews, as a second coming of Jerusalem. And Washington certainly saw it that way, and in his letter he borrowed from the Newport Jews a verbiage, a bigotry, no sanction, persecution, no assistance, and we're going to read it word line by line in a moment. Jews were appointed to federal positions, including Mordechai Emanuel Noah was appointed to the U.S. consulate in Riga in 1811 and in Tunis in 1813. Jews had a right to incorporate their congregations under the law, which was considered a big deal. Moses Myers, a leading American Jew, thought of America as the land of milk and honey, a promised land, a second Jerusalem. And Mordechai Noah, who had a scheme for a Jewish national home on Grand Island in the Niagara River in 1825, regarded his scheme as a new Jerusalem. So there is this concept that America is great, better than anywhere, any other diaspora the Jews have ever had. It's almost the promised land, or maybe it is the promised land. You wouldn't think this if you were being oppressed or you were being denied political rights. And yet it's a little bit of a mixed bag because there was some denial of political rights. Now, some Christians thought that American benevolence would lead the Jews to convert to Christianity. When that didn't happen, missionary organizations were founded. In 1820, the American Society for Ameliorating the Condition of the Jews was established. And so the goal was get the Jews to become Christian by persuasion. If just the political reality of a free America didn't do the trick, then use some theological propaganda. Other Gentiles thought that Jews deserved equality without a theological agenda because Jews acquitted themselves well during the revolution, meaning they fought for freedom together with the rest of us, with us Gentiles, so they deserve their measure of equality just as anybody else does. James Madison said that equality before the law was the best guarantee of loyalty and love of country, meaning if we're worried that subgroups of the population, ethnic minorities, religious minorities, will turn against us, the best thing we can do is give them absolute freedom and equality, and they'll love the country. Secure with their place in America, Jews invited prominent Gentiles to attend synagogue dedications, as would be appropriate for the dedication of any prominent civic institution, meaning, unlike in Europe, where you would never find that the local galach was invited to the dedication of a new shul, or hachnasas sefer Torah, in America, they would invite the local galach and the mayor and the governor and whomever whenever there was such a dedication, because the synagogue was as American as apple pie. The synagogue is just as American as the church. That was the feeling, that Jews had achieved that level, and so they could afford to bring in outsiders to watch these ceremonial occasions. Was there anti-Semitism in early Republican America? So the answer is there was some. And some of it was theological in nature, you know, Christ killer, rejected Jesus, that sort of thing. But most of it was due to religio-ethnic stereotypes about Jews and money, or Jewish aversion to manual labor. Jews took advantage of the freedom of speech to punch back and verbally defend themselves. So this is a very important point. Let me emphasize this point. If we could learn one thing tonight, it would be this one thing. In Europe, Jews were never able to fight with two hands in the intellectual realm and in the verbal realm of debate. They always had to be careful what they said, because if you win the debate, then you know what can happen? There could be a pogrom and everybody gets killed. You know, when the Ramban is doing his disputation, he has to worry. I want to win. I don't want to lose, but I can't win too big, because if I win too big, then they'll kill me and they'll kill all the Jews. In America, the Jew has freedom of speech. And so if there is an accusation leveled against Jewry that they are obsessed with money, or they don't want to work, they don't engage in farming, they're not loyal, blah, 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 whatever it might be, the Jewish propagandist is free to use every weapon in his arsenal to fight back and need not worry that there'll be repercussions. Okay. Anti-Semitism was exacerbated by sharp political divide between Federalists and Democratic Republicans. It's like that today, okay? Bismaneinu, in the days of Trump-Biden, you know, Jews don't sometimes have a problem where they're accused of being this way or that way. So when there is a sharp political divide in the country among the Gentiles, and Jews are thought to be overrepresented and one political party or one political persuasion, it becomes easy to malign them for their political viewpoint, just as it is for their economic or theological persuasion. Okay, now let's go to Washington's letter to the Jews. So For those of you who heard me give this talk once before, it's a repeat, my apologies, but not everybody heard it. So in 1787, the Constitution was written in Philadelphia. In 1788, various states adopted the Constitution. They ratified the Constitution. Well, the rule was that the Constitution becomes the law of the land if 9 out of the 13 states ratify the text. And that happened in the summer of 1788, in time for there to be an election in the fall of 1788 for the legislature, for the Senate and the House of Representatives, and for the presidency by means of the Electoral College. And George Washington would take the oath of office in April of 1789 in New York, of all places. So Washington did not like the idea that there were outlier states that had not ratified the Constitution. He wanted it to be unanimous. But some states were holding out, even though it was already the law of the land. Rhode Island was the last holdout. They were tough on this. Now, why? Because they were a small state, and they feared that the Constitution might be skewed towards favoring the larger states, because in the House of Representatives, the small states don't get nearly as much representation, okay? So Osher says, by 1791, all the states endorsed it. Correct, by 1790, they all did. And we're going to see that Rhode Island is the last one. And a deal was struck. A deal was struck between George Washington and state officials in Rhode Island that if they cut out their mishegas and ratify the Constitution, then Washington will visit Rhode Island. A state visit together with Thomas Jefferson and John Adams and the whole crew of the cabinet, or most of the cabinet, will go on a tour of New England and make a visit to Rhode Island. He had boycotted Rhode Island up until that point. So this works out, and Rhode Island ratifies the Constitution, and George Washington makes a visit in the summer of 1790, April 18th, to the state. And when he's there, he goes to Newport, and he encounters the Jewish community. The Jewish community writes the following letter to George Washington, and I will read it. Now I'm going to stop along the way to give my commentary. Sir, permit the children of the stock of Abraham to approach you with the most cordial affection and esteem for your person and merits, and to join with our fellow citizens and welcome you to Newport. So the fact that they use the expression stock of Abraham instead of saying Jews is because Jew is a dirty word. No one wants to use the word Jew, especially not Jews. We'd rather use the word Israelites, people of the Mosaic faith, stock of Abraham, any kind of biblical connotation other than Jew, because Jew has this dark conspiratorial overtone. Okay. Now, they say, join with our fellow citizens in welcoming them to Newport. Who said the Jews are citizens? Well, are the Jews citizens? According to the federal constitution, there are no religious tests for holding office. So the federal government is not putting Jews in a second-class position. However, many of the states are. In fact, in 1790, the vast bulk of the states had yet to fully emancipate their Jews. So to speak of fellow citizens is aspirational more than it is the reality. They're hoping that this will be the case. Maybe Washington will do something to make it the case. Then, with pleasure we reflect on those days of difficulty and danger, when the God of Israel, who delivered David from the peril of the sword, shielded your head in the day of battle. So they're recalling the tough times during the Revolutionary War. And they cite the verse, who delivered David from the peril of the sword, HaPotzeh David Avdo Mecherev Ra'ah, which we say in the davening, every time on Shabbos, we say the prayer for the welfare of the government. Right? So they're citing the Bible, or rather the sitter via the Bible, in order to reference the fact that we were with you in tough times. We rejoice to think that the same spirit who rested in the bosom of the greatly beloved Daniel, enabling him to preside over the provinces of the Babylonish Empire, rest and ever will rest upon you, enabling you to discharge the arduous duties of chief magistrate of these states. So chief magistrate means president. At the time, the term president of the United States was not so popular. Chief magistrate was more popularly known. Okay. So, what is this reference to Daniel? The reference to Daniel is that Daniel was an employee of Nebuchadnezzar, of the Babylonian Empire, and George Washington is being compared to Daniel in the sense that he shall execute public office in as virtuous a way as had Daniel. Derived as we heretofore have been of the invaluable rights of free citizens, we now, with deep sense of gratitude to the Almighty, disposer of all events, behold a government directed by the majesty of the people, a government which to bigotry gives no sanction, to persecution no assistance, but generously affording to all liberty of conscience and immunities of citizenship, deeming everyone of whatever nation, tongue, or language equal part of the great governmental machine. So the notion of a governmental machine is an Enlightenment era, or rather industrial revolution type term, a governmental machine that operates like a machine. The notion of nation, tongue, or language, nation here doesn't mean nation in the sense of US or Canada or France or Germany. Nation means like the Jewish nation, but without the, the Zionistic overtones. Just means an ethnic group, okay? And by referring to their earlier status as having been deprived of the invaluable rights of free citizens, what they're saying is, yeah, the Chutz La'aretz, the diaspora, the Galut, has always been bad to us. We've never had it good in the diaspora. But now, this is going to be really good. So they're drawing a sharp distinction between the life of the Chutz La'aretz Jew of yesteryear and the one of 1790s America then. This so ample and extensive federal union, whose basis is philanthropy, mutual confidence, and public virtue, we cannot but acknowledge to be the work of the great God who ruleth armies of heaven among the inhabitants of the earth, doing whatever seemeth him good. So America is great because God wants it to be great. And why does God want it to be great? Because its values are philanthropy, mutual confidence, and public virtue. In other words, America is built on a rock-solid moral foundation, and that's why God loves us, and that's why we're going to be successful. Real good patriotism, red, white, and blue. For all these blessings of civil and religious liberty, which we enjoy under equal benign administration, we desire to send up our thanks to the Ancient of Days, meaning God, the great preserver of men, beseeching him that the angel who conducted our forefathers to the wilderness and to the promised land may graciously conduct you through all the difficulties and dangers of this mortal life. So we're hoping that God, who watched us over in the Midbar, shall watch over you in America in the here and now. And when, like Joshua, so George Washington is being compared to Joshua, not Moses. Why is George Washington Joshua and not Moses? Who knows? George
His mother
Washington.
didn't get into the land, Joshua.
Ah, George Washington would have been Moses had he died during the Revolutionary War. But he lived and he won. And he's conquering the land and he's going to establish a new commonwealth. So Joshua crossed the Jordan River and defeated the people of Jericho and took over the country. That's why George Washington equals Joshua. Okay. So, and when like Joshua, full of days and full of honor, you are gathered into your fathers, meaning you die, may you be admitted into the heavenly paradise and partake of the water of life and the tree of immortality, meaning you should go to Gan Eden when you die. Now, when I taught this class at Anshi Shalom a number of months ago, and when I taught it in Scarsdale about a year ago, what did I say about this line? I said that if a person were to write a letter to the United States president today saying, when you die, you're going to go to heaven, the Secret Service would be sent to check out this fellow. Why is he talking about the president being dead? We don't talk about that. But in 1790, it was okay in a more spiritual, more religiously inclined society to speak about what happens in the hereafter. The hereafter is a big deal. And Washington was no spring chicken. He would die in 1799 anyway. So people want to know what happens in the afterlife. And they're saying, we Jews believe that you're a great man and you're going to go to heaven. You're going to go to Gan Eden. By the way, what is so special about them saying that? Well, what's special is he's not a Jew. Would a Christian say about a Jew, you're going to go to heaven? No. Why? Because without salvation and grace from Jesus, you're all damned to eternity. So what we see here is the Jews are emphasizing that the Umos HaOlam, the people of the nations of the world, the Ben Noachs, the Noachides, the heathens, the Gentiles, as long as you're a good person, what? You go to heaven. So that's a very charitable thing that, that Jews have in, you know, their arsenal of things to say, because we're not a universal church. We're an ethnic, we're an ethno-national religion. And we can afford to say that even if you're not one of us, you can go to heaven. Okay. Then, done by the order of the Hebrew Congregation of Newport, signed Moses Satius, warden. Moses Satius was the brother of Gershom Mendes Satius, the Chazan of Sherith Israel. Okay. Well, how does George Washington reply? So Washington's reply was sent a few days later when he was on the road back home to Washington. And although it was written by his scribe, it was not in his personal handwriting. He dictated the words. This is his verbiage. Gentlemen, while I receive with much satisfaction your address replete with expressions of esteem, I rejoice in the opportunity of assuring you that I shall always retain grateful remembrance of the cordial welcome I experienced in my visit to Newport from all classes of citizens. So he's mentioning, you know, thanks a lot. It was a nice time I had at Newport. It was good to meet you. And I'll always remember this. But he mentions all classes of citizens, meaning right off the bat, you Jews are citizens. Then, the reflection on the days of difficulty and danger, which are past, meaning the days of the war, the Revolutionary War, is rendered more sweet from a consciousness that they are succeeded by days of uncommon prosperity and security. So it's okay to remember the travails and the difficulties of the late 1770s, early 1780s, because now in 1790, what? The economy is good. We have peace. Everything is wonderful. Now, it's quite self-serving for the American president to say at any one time, yeah, under my watch, everything is great. You know, it's like the President Trump saying the economy is roaring and unemployment's at 3%. So Washington is tooting his own horn here, saying it was tough 10 years ago, but it's great now. Okay. If we have wisdom to make the best use of the advantages with which we are now favored, we cannot fail under the just administration of a good government to become a good, great and happy people. The notion of being happy, someone's asking, did Washington visit Touro? Yes, Washington was at the Touro Synagogue. This was an important visit by the leader of the United States of America to a Jewish house of worship. So he says, we're going to become a great and happy people. What does that mean? Happiness, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. In the Enlightenment period, and especially in the American wing of the Enlightenment, happiness was considered an ultimate goal. But not happiness in the sense of petty happiness, like I'm happy I had a good dinner tonight, I had a steak and French fries, but rather like in the more general sense of broader well-being, societal well-being. Okay. Well, then, the citizens of the United States of America have a right to applaud themselves for having given to mankind examples of an enlarged and liberal policy, a policy worthy of imitation, meaning we are an Or LaGoyim. You know, Jews think of themselves as a light unto the nations, an Or LaGoyim. Well, America is the new Israel, so America is an Or LaGoyim. The rest of the world, you know, old Europe, old primitive bigoted Europe is looking at America to see how you can be progressive in giving emancipation to all categories of citizens, that they represent, you know, pre-modern medieval prejudice, and we represent the way forward. All possess alike liberty of conscience and the immunities of citizenship. Okay, good. It is now no more that toleration is spoken of, as if it were the indulgence of one class of people that another enjoyed the exercise of their inherent natural rights. For happily for the government of the United States, which gives to bigotry no sanction, persecution no assistance, requires only that those who live under its protection should demean themselves as good citizens in giving all their occasions effectual support. Which means Washington is going one step further than was even expected of him by the Jews of Newport. What is tolerance, toleration? Tolerance is when I don't like you, but I hold my tongue and I restrain my hand from oppressing you, and I let you be, even though you don't necessarily deserve it and you don't have the virtues that I have. Nonetheless, out of the goodness of my heart, I'll let you have some of the advantages of the prerogatives of citizenship. The classic example of that is the 1782 tolerance patent by Joseph II of the Habsburg Empire, where Judaism and Jews were not seen as equal of the Catholic Church or even the Protestant denominations. Jews are inferior. and Judaism is inferior, but we'll let you do this and that because it's good for the economy, and we want to be nice about it. So what George Washington is saying is, that's not America. In America, it's not as though we're a Christian country that, as out of the goodness of our hearts, extends a couple of token rights to Jews. Not at all, no. But rather, the government gives bigotry no sanction, persecution no assistance, meaning we are neutral on matters of religion, and we're not going to allow the oppression of any religious group, because everyone is entitled by natural right to the same level playing field of political rights. Okay? And all we expect of you is that you demean yourself as a good citizen. So is this line about demeaning yourself as a good citizen a way of Washington backtracking on his promise? Meaning, is he in the back of his mind thinking that the Jews really aren't loyal, and this is sort of a test, and if they behave in a loyal fashion, we'll give them the rights, but if they don't, we'll withhold it from them? Some wanted to say that Washington's little line over here is a caveat that undoes the greatness of the whole letter. I don't see it that way, because what I think he really means is that everyone, regardless of religious affiliation and regardless of national background, is to behave themselves as a good citizen, because we need everyone to behave like good citizens. After all, there's the Whiskey Rebellion, the Shays Rebellion. You know, there have been rebellions in the 1780s and 1790s America, following on the heels of the rebellion, the revolution itself, which was a rebellion against the British, you know, against the Stamp Act, the Tea Act. So there's a history, a 40-year history in the United States, dating back to colonial times, of people being Wildechaies and, you know, rebelling whenever they don't like something in terms of the governance of the country. So what Washington says is, we can't have that anymore. Now that we have our Constitution, everybody's got to play fair by the rules we've adopted, you Jews included. So it's not specific to the Jews. He's not trying to say, you, we're watching you. It's, we're watching everybody. We want everybody to behave. Okay. Then, it would be inconsistent with the frankness of my character not to avow that I am pleased with your favorable opinion of my administration and fervent wishes for my felicity. In other words, he's saying, thanks for the kind words. I really appreciate it. May the children of the stock of Abraham who dwell in this land continue to merit and enjoy the goodwill of other inhabitants. So he uses the expression stock of Abraham. He doesn't say Jews. Why doesn't he say Jews? Well, the Jews didn't say Jews. So he figures, if you want to use the term stock of Abraham, gesinnte, hey, I'll use it too. It's an awkward phrase. I'm sure Washington would never have come up with it on his own. But having seen it in the letter he received, he responded in kind. Okay. Then, he wants them to continue to enjoy the goodwill of other inhabitants. Why does he mention this? Well, he mentions it because it's not a foregone conclusion that they will have the goodwill of the other inhabitants. You know, in other parts of the world, the Gentile neighbor hates the Jew and hates the Jew with a passion. So will America be different? We hope so, but we can't know for sure. So he's hoping that the Jews will merit and deserve that. Meaning, if you guys behave nicely, then your next door neighbor who's a Gentile will think well of you and won't be bigoted and won't be guided by prejudice. While everyone shall sit in safety under his own vine and fig tree, and there shall be none to make them afraid. So, yashav ish tachat gafno v'tachat te'inato, right out of the Bible, under the vine and fig tree, and v'ein macharid, none shall make you afraid. So the ultimate thing that the Jew wants, well, are twofold. One, economic prosperity. Jews always running around the world trying to find where they can make parnassa, because it's in many parts of the world it's forbidden to them. And personal safety and security, the Ein Macharid. You want to live in a country where you're not afraid there's going to be a pogrom tomorrow. So in America, what Washington is saying is that we hope you'll have that physical security and material prosperity. May the Father of all mercies scatter light and not darkness upon our paths, and make us in our several vocations useful here, and in his own due time and way, everlastingly happy. Again, happiness is a nice way to conclude. But what's this business of lightness and not darkness? Well, because in the Enlightenment period, especially in the American Enlightenment, light is good and darkness is bad. Darkness represents all the primitive forces of pre-modern times. And in our several vocations useful here, so in the Enlightenment period, again, that's another point, that people exist in this world to be productive, not to be idle. The truth is, Judaism says the same thing. Lo l'tohu bara'a, God did not create the world so that it should be weltering waste and chaos, but rather la shevet yitzara. It was created so it should be, civilization could be cultivated. Okay, that we should build it up. And what do we say about a person who's a dice player, a gambler? He's pasul la'edus, you're not allowed to be a witness in halacha. We say, eino osek bi yishuvo shel olam. This person is not engaged in the settling of the world, the creation of a society, of a civilization. So Washington is saying the same thing. We want to be useful in our vocations, and we'll be everlastingly happy. Okay, yegia kapecha ki tochel ashrecha v'tov lach, right out of the Bible. Very nice. So Washington's letter, which was received by the community in Newport, made the Jews very happy. It was not the only letter that Washington wrote to the Jews. The community in Savannah wrote a separate one, and the communities of Charleston, Richmond, Philadelphia, and New York combined to write one. So there were three letters to Washington and three responses. However, the one to Newport is by far the most famous and has given Newport, the Yeshivat Yisrael congregation, Torah synagogue, a piece of place in American history. Okay, so in the time we have left, I want to mention an incident that happened in 1815. So in 1815, President James Monroe recalled from his position Mordechai Emanuel Noah, who had been appointed shortly a few years earlier as consul general at the U.S. consulate in Tunis, in the Barbary States, in the north coast of Africa. Why did he recall Manuel Noah from his position? Quote, in the letter, at the time of your appointment, it was not known that the religion which you profess would form any obstacle to your consular services. Oh, that means we didn't know at the time that the fact that you're a Jew was going to be a problem in appointing you to a State Department position in a Muslim country. So therefore, now that we realize there's a problem, you got to come home. Your commission is revoked. Now, the truth of the matter is, that might have been a cover story for some other reason of state to recall the consular official. But on the surface of it, it was saying that even though this is America and the federal government has no religious test for office holding, still, the U.S. consular official in a Muslim country, yeah, we probably shouldn't appoint a Jew. Now, can you imagine if in 1991, during the Gulf War, Dennis Ross or somebody was recalled from Saudi Arabia because President Bush or Secretary of State James Baker were to say, well, we didn't realize that sending a Jew to Saudi Arabia was going to cause such a problem, so come home. You couldn't do that. And the Saudis had to learn to live with the fact that some Jewish, some American State Department officials were Jews. So, but in 1815, it's not nice. Not nice. It's a kapachin panim to the Jewish community. So what happened? Isaac Harvey of Charleston wrote a strongly worded response to President Monroe, attacking Monroe's decision to recall Manuel Noah. And I'll read it to you from Harvey. Harvey, it is upon the principle not of toleration, for man has no power to tolerate religion, that is a concern between man and his maker, but upon the principle of equal, inalienable, constitutional rights that we see Jews appointed to offices, that we see them elected in our state representation, and that in proportion as their talents and their influence can bear them through, we see their mingling in the honors of their country. There are by no means to be considered as a religious sect tolerated by the government. They constitute a portion of the people. They are, in every respect, woven in and compacted with the citizens of the Republic, Quakers and Catholics, Episcopalians and Presbyterians, Baptists and Jews, all constitute one great political family. So what Isaac Harvey is here saying is that toleration, that's, you know, the old days in Europe. That's not America, where you, the dominant religion, get to boss us around and that there are limits to the extent of your tolerance. No, there should be no limits because it's not about tolerance that we're talking about here, but rather constitutional rights, that Jews can be elected, Jews can vote, hold public office, and achieve high honor in society on the basis of their worth, what they can contribute. And we're just as good as the Episcopalians and the Quakers and the Catholics, etc., etc. Meaning it doesn't matter what religion you are, we're all the same, at least as far as civic participation should be concerned. So this was Harvey's letter to Monroe. Did it work? Well, Manuel Noah was not put back in his position, but I think the message was well received by the federal government that they can no longer do this, that Jews, like anybody else, are entitled to government service positions, and you can't recall them just because their religion is inconvenient. Okay? Now, in truth, what Harvey was saying was, again, more aspirational than it was the reality, because Jews did not have full political rights in all the states. It was a process that would extend throughout the period of 1783 to 1820. New York gave Jews full political rights in 1777. Virginia, courtesy of what was written by Thomas Jefferson, did so in 1785. South Carolina and Pennsylvania in 1790, Delaware in 1792, Georgia in 1798, Connecticut in 1818, and Massachusetts in 1821, and the Maryland Jew Bill in 1826, about which we discussed last week. And certain states, including New Hampshire, wouldn't give Jews full emancipation and eliminate all discriminatory laws until 1876. So what Harvey was saying was what he wanted to be true, but wasn't really 100% true just yet. This will be the last time I discuss the political rights of Jews, because by 1820, and certainly within the short time thereafter, this will be a fait accompli, and Jews will have the same sorts of rights that we are familiar with today of voting and holding public office. Okay, so in the last few minutes that we have left, I want to explain why there is now a transition from what we call the Sephardic period, or the colonial and early Republican period, to what is the next period of German dominance. So, as I mentioned, there wasn't much immigration of Jews, at least, from Europe, or for that matter, even from the Caribbean, to mainland United States in the early Republican period. Why not? Well, things were chaotic in Europe, and it wasn't easy to get across the ocean, but also, there was some progress being made in Europe in the sense of the French Revolution, the conferring of civil rights upon Jews of France, and then in the Napoleonic Wars upon the Jews of those parts of Central Europe, meaning Germany and Italy, where Napoleon's armies conquered. And if Jews are going to get rights, then they're disinclined to leave. They'll stay where they are. However, when emancipation is not a one-way, a straight shot, a straight trajectory, but rather emancipation has its ups and downs, where things look good for the moment, but then there's a reversal, of course, people become very disillusioned. Okay, if you thought you were going to have full rights in 1814 Germany, but all of a sudden it's now 1820, and you don't have full rights, and there's been a conservative political reaction under Metternich to what had been the liberalism under Napoleonic rule, well, you're going to become really disillusioned. Someone was asking in the chat, were there any other groups subjected to restricted legal rights? The answer is yes, not just Jews. In some states, you had Protestant pluralism, meaning if you were a Protestant denomination, you could vote, you could hold office, but if you were not Protestant, you couldn't swear the good faith of a Christian, then you were disadvantaged. So that might mean Catholics, it might mean Mohammedans, it might mean atheists, it might mean anyone other than the key Protestant denominations. But over time, all those disabilities go away. Now, back to what I was saying. So in Central Europe, things are not good under the conservative reaction. And there are the Hep riots of 1819, where some Jews are killed and a lot of Jewish property is damaged. So Jews look across the ocean and they see greater opportunity in the United States than they find for themselves in the various principalities and duchies and city-states of Central Europe, of Germany and Austria. So they go on the move. not in tremendous numbers, but in numbers that are large enough to dramatically shift the balance of the American Jewish community. Remember, if there are only 3,000 Jews in America in 1820, it only takes a few boatfuls of people to upset the apple cart to change the balance. And so what we're going to find next week when we discuss the 1820s is that the Ashkenazim want religious services conducted according to their rite and are no longer satisfied with the old Spanish-Portuguese method. And yes, it was true in the colonial period and early Republican period that they were Ashkenazim. In fact, there was a majority Ashkenazim, but they made peace with, or they came to terms with, davening under a rite, a nusach, which wasn't their own indigenous nusach. But by the 1820s, that's not true anymore. Also, there are going to be differences in the level of religious observance. The newcomers from Europe are going to be frum, at least in the early years, before they have to abandon their frumkeit to make a living. And when they arrive, they see these people, American Jews, are not religious in the least, at least by the standards that we have, and are Hebraically illiterate. So we want to up the standard. Also, there is a socioeconomic divide where the older crowd are a bunch of snooty elitists, and the younger people have not yet made themselves financially and are not walking in the same social circles as their co-religionists. And so the fact that they are co-religionists only goes so far. And this will cause fissures in the communities, result in the establishment of many more synagogues, and also result in the creation of new Jewish communities in places where Jews didn't previously live. And they're going to push further and further west to the Mississippi River and beyond. Okay, so the expansion of America with the Louisiana Purchase in 1803 and the settling of the frontier means that Jews are also going to go to the frontier further and further west. Okay, so this will not be done by the old guard Spanish-Portuguese elite Jews. It'll be done by peddlers, by backpackers who are willing to go into the hinterland, into the middle of nowhere, to make whatever living that they could. So we'll stop here. Any questions? Questions? Any questions?
So is it a given when they go west that they eat trade, if not the worst trade?
That's a very good question. The answer is that some people who had the pack on their back as a peddler would keep kosher to the best of their ability by refraining from eating meat. They would have dairy and they would have parav, and they would have fish, but they would avoid meat. Others would come to grips with eating treif and try to avoid the worst offenses, meaning pork. But as for not properly slaughtered, you know, non-shechted beef, yeah, some people would have to eat it just to fill their belly. Remember an important thing. Reform Judaism does not take off in Europe in any really substantial way until about the 1840s. It is the earliest phases of reform in Europe, and we discussed this 2 years ago, as early as 1810 with Israel Jacobson in the Seton Temple, in the Hamburg Temple of 1818. But there's a conservative reaction in the 1820s, 1830s. It's not until the 1840s that there's real ideological reform spreading all throughout Europe, which means that the earliest manifestations of reform in America are not really borrowed from European reform. They would later on, when the rabbis came, the reform rabbis, they would be borrowed from European ideologies. But the earliest tinkering with the tradition and laxity in religious observance by the individual Jew is not the result of some theological revolution in the doctrines. You know,
it's significant. It's significant that the 1843 establishment of B'nai B'rith, the international order by 13 German Jews, were intended to take the place of a Keilah. It was a secular and it was reformist in its
aim. We're going to discuss with the founding of the B'nai B'rith that there are people who are not interested in the synagogue.
Right.
The concept of the synagogue. What some Jewish affiliation, but under the auspices of a secular organization, and they'll be able to have it. And in America, more so than anywhere else in the world, they'll be able to have it.
Okay. In my own mind, how did you answer that question? was there a period, a kind of dancing going around? Were the Jewish leaders of Touro Synagogue encouraged to ask for the visit in order for the officials of Washington not to lose face in case they made it on their own? They initiated the meeting.
Oh, so yeah, it's true that the community in Newport was aware that if Washington showed up and was not given a prior invitation,
yeah,
and a warm welcome, that it would look badly upon, it would reflect badly upon the community. So this was all orchestrated ahead of time.
Oh, it was, yeah.
With an invitation and with a proclamation read in a public square by the Christians, by the Jews, and by the Freemasons.
Okay.
it was all done, orchestrated ahead of time to make sure everybody looked good and saved face.
And okay. It went flawlessly, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it went very well. Okay, last question, was immigration open or what were restrictions imposed? Okay, immigration was open. Restrictions on immigration do not happen until 100 years later, until basically 1917. Okay. Next week. Take care.
Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.